Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
So I was looking through the Times of Israel, as I do on a daily basis, and I came across this really fascinating article dealing with a professor at Stellenbosch University who's written a book here, and I had to find out about it in the Times of Israel. His name is Dr. Evert Kleinhans, and he's written a book called Hitler's South African Spies, and I thought, how fantastic would it be to chat to the man himself. Doc, thank you for joining us on Chai FM this afternoon.
Thank you, Simon. If you want to promote me to a professor, you must also just pay my salary then. But thank you for that.
Okay, happy to do that. So absolutely fascinating that you stumbled upon this bit of history that, you know, let me start again. We all know about the Robbie Lebruns. We all know about the Osava Brandwach. We all know about certain of our grandparents who arrived off boats to people wearing swastikas on their arms. But who knew that there were spies in Cape Town spying for Germany?
Yeah, look, it's such a fascinating part of our history. And I think for a long time, well, at least after 1948, it's actually been suppressed. And not much has been written about it, but I came upon this part of our history when I was researching my PhD, and I looked at the naval war in South African waters, and the one thing that perplexed me mm-hmm. was, you know, if you're going to send German U-boats to operate in South African waters, they would have to act on some sort of intelligence or information, and that sort of put me down a tangent where I got, you know, stuck into this intelligence war and trying to figure out who were the main role players and what they were after and what they reported on.
So I'd love delve into that for us for a moment. Who were they? What were they after? And how did they transfer the information to Germany at a time when technology wasn't very developed?
So there was the two principal spies in South Africa during the war was, first of all, a guy named Hans Rissebaum, who was a parliamentary reporter. He was recruited by the Abwehr when he was stuck in Germany at the outbreak of the war. I mean, stuck in inverted commas. And he was dispatched to South Africa to report on both political and naval intelligence. You know, what was happening in South Africa, the Germans were interested in the Osava Brandwach and the sort of activistic element within the country and how they could actively use them probably to further the German war effort. And then, of course, naval intelligence to see if it'd be worthwhile to send U-boats or battleships or surface raiders to come and launch operations in South African waters, which they did. And I can speak about that in a bit. But then the second spy was a guy named Lothar Zittig, and his code name was Felix. Mm-hmm. And he was the most active of these spies in South Africa and probably for the longest period. So they would collect the information from along the South African coastline, and this would be reported back up to Pretoria, sort of in the vicinity there. And initially, the intelligence would be passed along to Maputo in Mozambique, or Lorenzo Marx, as it was known then.
Yeah.
And then it would be transmitted from there to Germany via diplomatic ciphers or cables. But later on in the war, the spies actually succeeded in building a two-way radio that could directly communicate with Berlin. So they were able to send messages three or four times a week and send it directly to the Abwehr in Berlin that would then distribute it further on to whoever was going to use it.
Evert, to what extent were they successful?
In terms of reporting on the political situation within the country, I would say that they were very successful, but it didn't have a marked influence on the war effort. I mean, it didn't really influence the Axis war effort at all. The naval intelligence, according to me, that's my insight, that it didn't mean anything, because the turnaround time, by the time this information was collected and dispatched to Germany, and if it had acted upon by submarines, it could have been days or you know, a number of days. So I question the real value of the naval intelligence. I don't think it was effective. And by the time that this direct link between Germany became operational, at that stage of the war, the naval war in South African waters had all but dissipated already. So it wasn't that effective.
You know, it's really difficult to look back because it was so long ago, but one has to remember that a Boer War had just been fought, what, 45 years before then. There clearly was massive schisms between the English population and the Afrikaans population, and one can absolutely understand why there would be an attraction on behalf of Afrikaners to support the German effort against the English. If you're Jewish, however, you've got a very different perspective on the matter because for obvious reasons. To what extent did anti-Semitism play a role in their beliefs, if at all? I'm talking about the Afrikaners who adopted that kind of a sympathy or strategy.
The Osterwald Brandwach, I mean, it started, they were always touted as starting out as a cultural organization, and it became a bit more militant and radical as the war progressed. I think there was definitely strong elements of anti-Semitism within certain segments of the organization, and that obviously fueled their drive to also help the German war effort. And you can pick this up. I mean, any young student out there that maybe wants to embark on a postgraduate degree in history could go look at the Osterwald Brandwach archive in Potchefstroom and sort of, you know, look at the extent of anti-Semitism within the organization. It wasn't really my focus area, but I did come across some elements of it.
Was there any point at which the southern, what was it called then? We were republics. I don't know what we were. The entity, the union. There you go, yeah. The union. Was the union ever under threat?
Look, these guys, the Osterwald Brandwach had these grandiose ideas that, you know, Rommel would be arriving in South Africa and they would be able to free themselves from the British yoke and, you know, establish a new republic. But I mean, realistically, there was the chances of a German expeditionary force rocking up on South African shores was very slim. I think they had bigger problems, you know, 1941, 1942. The tide of the war had already turned against them. So I think there was a hope within in certain segments of the Afrikaner community that the Germans would give them their freedom. But the biggest threat would have been the naval threat along our coast. So the sinking of ships, that would have been the biggest threat, according to me.
And I think in that article it quotes a certain amount of tonnage that actually went down. They did pretty well, didn't they, the Germans?
Yeah, so from October 1942 till about August 1943, that was the heart of the naval war. And then the U-boats sort of had a free hand at sinking ships along our coast. I think during the war years, there was a total of 153 ships sunk.
Wow.
Which, if you compare it to the global results, it's not that impressive. But, I mean, in South African waters, it was hundreds of thousands of tonnage of shipping being sunk. But that being said, the Allied countermeasures in our waters became very effective. We managed to sink three German U-boats along the South African coast during the war. So by 1943, 1944, it was not a happy place to be a German U-boat commander.
But tell me, because this is actually really quite personal. I've got very strong memories of standing in a cemetery in Worcester looking at family member who had died. I think he was 21 years old. And he was exactly one of these people. He was a returning soldier. I think he'd been in North Africa. U-boat got the boat and he died. How many people like that were there? How many soldiers besides good? How many soldiers were killed returning home?
That's a very, very interesting point. I think there's two parts to that answer, Simon. The one interesting thing was that Hans von Rensburg of the Osterwald Brandwach never sent through intelligence to Germany that would influence the lives of South African soldiers. So if there was a troop ship leaving South African waters, he would refuse to pass along information to the Germans.
Wow.
Very interesting.
Wow.
But I know that there were one or two occasions. Obviously, there were people that lost their lives. The big troop ship, I just forget its name now, that was sunk, was it was off the east coast of South Africa where we lost quite a few lives of troops returning from the north. And, of course, I think there was a number of Italian prisoners of war also on that ship. So yes, there were, of course, incidences like that as well.
Just trying to think, what crime were these guys actually committing in terms of Union law at the time?
Well, after the war, from about 1945, Jan Smuts ordered, that there was two, what would you call them now, commissions started to to investigate all South African nationals that were guilty of treason against the state. So this included civilians and then also members in uniform that served in the Union Defence Force. So, for instance, guys that were prisoners of war during the war and then that became stool pigeons, or they actively worked with the Germans in the camps, or they joined the British Free Corps, the SS unit. So that was the one element. And then, of course, the civilians included people that worked at Radio Zeeland that broadcasted propaganda back to South Africa that were still South African citizens. And Hans van Rensburg, of course, that was the sort of, let's call him the kingpin in this whole intelligence saga. So the biggest drive was led by a guy named Lawrence Barrett, the Barrett Commission. They went to Europe and they scoured post-war Europe, did interviews with some of the main role players that were involved in it, at least from the German side, the consular staff in Maputo. And they built this high treason case against van Rensburg and members within the Oswald Brandtag. And in December 1947, they delivered their final report, and it was titled Rex versus Johannes Jante. Rex versus Hans van Rensburg and others, the case of high treason or something like that. And Smuts was reticent to move it to go to court, even though Barrett had said that there's enough evidence to go ahead with a treason charge. Because I think he was wary of the 1948 election looming.
Yeah.
And so he held back. And of course, then the National Party won the election. And the whole matter took a drastic turn. Of course, some of the Nationalist Party government members were implicated in this. J.F. Malan had actually been contacted by the Germans during the war as well. He didn't act upon it, but he was implicated. So all of the copies of this report, I think there were six, it's rounded up and handed over to the new Minister of Justice. They briefly debated in Parliament, and then it's handed to the state archivist for safekeeping. Now, I can tell you, I went to the National Archive, and I tried every possible keyword and finding aid that you could get to try to get my hands on that final copy of the Barrett report, and I couldn't find it. It magically disappeared. And what I was interested in was all of the appendices at the back that included all of these intercepted communications between the German agents in South Africa and Berlin. And that's just not there.
Eric, we've got a question from a listener in Israel, of all places, wanting to know if Foster was a Nazi.
Look, I know Foster was a member of the Oswald Brandtag, and he was interned during the war, but in my research, he was never really involved in the intelligence side of this whole undertaking. But he was definitely a member of the Oswald Brandtag.
I'm going to leave it here. What a fascinating interview we've just had. Wonderful responses coming in. You've gone down very well. I think we are talking to the right audience as far as your book is concerned. Where can we buy your book?
So the book has been out for about 6 or 7 months. You can find it in exclusive books, bargain books, or online at Takealot or Loot, wherever. And then for listeners abroad in Europe and North America and Israel, you can find it on Amazon. It was published abroad as Hitler's South African Spies. So, yeah, it's available. There's audio books, and I think there's also a Kindle version out there as well.
Evert Clenans, what a privilege it was to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you for being with us on Chai FM.
Yeah, all right. Take care.